You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome. Pleasure to see you here for what I think will be a very special evening at Aloud. I'm Louise Steinman, the Program Director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. You know, from our West Coast vantage point, we've watched in recent weeks in dismay as a hurricane recently pounded the East Coast of the country. Well, if you want a deeply insightful look at the country's previous hurricane disaster before Sandy, I recommend poet Natasha Trethewey's beautiful book, Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which was published in 2010. Trethewey looks at this vast devastation with sober and poetic eyes. She spent her childhood in Gulfport, Mississippi, and weaves her own memories with the experiences of family, friends, and neighbors. She looks at the erosion of local culture and the erosion of the wetlands through the lens of personal storytelling. And as well as being one of our most indispensable poets, Natasha Trethewey is a prose writer of the first order, which I'm sure you will see when you read this wonderful book. Her first book of poems, Domestic Work, was selected by former poet laureate Rita Dove as winner of the inaugural 1999 Cavicanum Poetry Prize. And her subsequent poetry collections include Belloc Ophelia and Native Guard, which was awarded the 2007 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. And tonight, we celebrate the publication of her fourth book of poetry, Thrall, that one with a very beautiful cover. Poet David St. John called this newest book simply the finest work of Natasha Trethewey's already distinguished career. These lyric poems attest to memories of her own mixed-race childhood, and as David Baker says, tracing the curses of the blended, the bonded, and the enthralled. Many of them were inspired by the 18th century Costa paintings by Spanish artists, which cataloged the complex system of labels that society gave to children of mixed race relationships in Mexico and other parts of the world. And as with her past collection, Natasha's intersection of national and personal experience haunts these new poems. Natasha Trethewey is currently the Charles Howard Candler Professor of English and Creative Writing at Emory University, and this past June, the Librarian of Congress, James Billington, named her as the nation's 19th Poet Laureate, and she began the one-year position this September. And in addition to serving as the U.S. Poet Laureate, those of you who are here to hear a Poet Laureate, you're getting a double. She's also serving 4 years as Poet Laureate for Mississippi, and she's the first person to serve simultaneously as Poet Laureate for a state and the nation. And as interlocutor for our distinguished guest tonight, I want to welcome Rob Casper, who, as I said, is the head of the Poetry and Literature Center at the Library of Congress. With Rob's help, we've had poet Philip Levine here before. We've done many programs working with Rob when he was programs director for the Poetry Society of America. It's always a delight to have his expertise, humor, and creativity as part of this collaboration. Now, without further ado, please join me in welcoming the U.S. Poet Laureate, Natasha Trethewey, to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. Thank you very much. It is lovely to be here with you tonight in this beautiful library. And I am going to read a little bit from my new book, Thrall. And Thrall is, in many ways, a meditation on the past, on knowledge, and about the long-standing history of ideas about race across time and space, notions of deeply ingrained and unexamined about inherent difference, many of which come from the Enlightenment of all things. These are notions that are manifest in larger public discourses, but also even in the smaller intimate relations within families. It's a book very much an intimate conversation that I'm having with my poet father in a very public forum. Elegy for my father. I think by now the river must be thick with salmon. Late August, I imagine it as it was that morning, drizzle needling the surface, mist at the banks like a net settling around us, everything damp and shining. That morning, awkward and heavy in our hip waders, we stalked into the current and found our places, you upstream a few yards and out far deeper. You must remember how the river seeped in over your boots and you grew heavier with that defeat. All day I kept turning to watch you, how first you mimed our guide's casting, then cast your invisible line, slicing the sky between us. And later, rod in hand, how you tried again and again to find that perfect arc, flight of an insect skimming the river's surface. Perhaps you recall I cast my line and reeled in two small trout we could not keep. Because I had to release them, I confess, I thought about the past, working the hooks loose, the fish writhing in my hands, each one slipping away before I could let go. I can tell you now that I tried to take it all in, record it for an elegy I'd write one day when the time came. Your daughter, I was that ruthless. What does it matter if I tell you I learned to be? You kept casting your line, and when it did not come back empty, it was tangled with mine. Some nights, dreaming, I step again into the small boat that carried us out and watch the bank receding, my back to where I know we are headed. Thank you. This next poem is about those Mexican casta paintings, paintings across the 18th century in colonial Mexico that represented the mixed blood unions that were taking place in the colony. I was particularly intrigued by them because not only did they begin in series of 16 with the white Spaniard father, but they also had not only the taxonomies of the parents, but also the taxonomies of the offspring they would have made right there on the painting. I was also interested in the idea that indigenous blood could, over a few generations, be purified to whiteness, but that the taint of African blood was irreversible. So you had names like Mulatto Returning Backwards, Hold Yourself in Midair, and I Don't Understand You, names that were recorded upon birth in the Book of Castas. This is after a series by Juan Rodriguez Suarez, circa 1715. Taxonomy. 1. De Español y de India produce mestizo. The canvas is a leaden sky behind them, heavy with words, gold letters inscribing an equation of blood. This plus this equals this, as if a contract with nature, or a museum label, ethnographic, precise. See how the father's hand, beneath its crown of lace, curls around his daughter's head. She's nearly fair as he is, calidad. See it in the brooch at her collar, the lace framing her face. An infant, she is born over the servant's left shoulder, bound to him by a sling, the plain blue cloth knotted at his throat. If the father, his hand on her skull, divines, as the physiognomist does, the mysteries of her character, discursive, legible on her light flesh, in the soft curl of her hair, we cannot know it, so gentle the eye he turns toward her. The mother, glancing sideways toward him, the scarf on her head, white as his face, his powdered wig, gestures with one hand a shape like the letter C. C, she seems to say, what we have made. The servant, still a child, cranes his neck, turns his face up toward all of them. He is dark as history, origin of the word native, the weight of blood, a pale mistress on his back, heavier every year. 2. De Español y Negra produce mulatto. Still, the centuries have not dulled the sullenness of the child's expression. If there is light inside him, it does not shine through the paint that holds his face in profile, his domed forehead, eyes nearly closed beneath a heavy brow. Though inside, the boy's father stands in his cloak and hat, it's as if he's just come in, or that he's leaving. We see him transient, rolling a cigarette, myopic, his eyelids drawn against the child passing before him. At the stove, the boy's mother contorts, watchful, her neck twisting on its spine, red beads yoked at her throat like a necklace of blood, her face so black she nearly disappears into the canvas, the dark wall upon which we see the words that name them. What should we make of any of this? Remove the words above their heads, put something else in place of the child, a table, perhaps, upon which the man might set his hat, or a dog upon which to bestow the blessing of his touch, and the story changes. The boy is a palimpsest of paint, layers of color, history rendering him that precise shade of in between. Before this, he was nothing, blank canvas, before image or word, before a last brushstroke fixed him in his place. 3. De Español y Mestiza produce Castiza. How not to see in this gesture the mind of the colony? In the mother's arms, the child, hinged at her womb, dark cradle of mixed blood, call it Mexico, turns toward the father, reaching to him as if back to Spain, to the promise of blood alchemy, 3 easy steps to purity. From a Spaniard and an Indian, a mestizo. From a mestizo and a Spaniard, a castizo. From a castizo and a Spaniard, a Spaniard. We see her here, 1 generation away, nearly slipping her mother's careful grip. 4. The Book of Castas. Call it the catalog of mixed bloods, or the book of not Spaniard, not white, but mulatto returning backwards, or hold yourself in midair, and the Morisca, the Lobo, the Chino, Sambo, Albino, and the No Te Entiendo, the I don't understand you. Guidebook to the colony, record of each crossed birth, it is the typology of taint, of stain, blemish, sullying spot, that which can be purified, that which cannot, Canaan's black fate. How like a dirty joke, it seems. What do you call that space between the dark geographies of sex? Call it the taint, as in it taint one and it taint the other. Illicit and yet naming still what is between. Between her parents, the child, mulatto returning backwards, cannot slip their hold, the triptych their bodies make, in paint, in blood, her name, written down in the book of Castas, all her kind in thrall to a word. As I mentioned, my father is also a poet, and this next poem makes use of a line from one of his poems. This is after a chalk drawing by J.H. Hasselhorst, 1864. Knowledge. Whoever she was, she comes to us like this, lips parted, long hair spilling from the table like water from a pitcher, nipples drawn out for inspection. perhaps to foreshadow the object she'll become, a skeleton on a pedestal, a row of skulls on a shelf. To make a study of the ideal female body, four men gather around her. She is young and beautiful and drowned, a Venus de Medici risen from the sea, sleeping. As if we could mistake this work for sacrilege, the artist entombs her body in a pyramid of light, a temple of science over which the anatomist presides. In the service of beauty, to know it, he lifts a flap of skin beneath her breast as one might draw back a sheet. We will not see his step-by-step parsing, a translation, Mary or Catherine or Elizabeth, to corpus, areola, vulva. In his hands, instruments of the empirical, scalpel, pincers, cold, as the room must be cold, all the men in coats, trimmed in velvet or fur, soft as the down of her pubis. Now one man is smoking. Another tilts his head to get a better look. Yet another, at the head of the table, peers down as if enthralled, his fist on a stack of books. In the drawing, this is only the first cut, a delicate wounding, and yet how easily the anatomist's blade opens a place in me, like a curtain drawn upon a room in which each learned man is my father, and I hear again his words. I study my crossbreed child. Misnomer and taxonomy, the language of zoology. Here he is all of them, the preoccupied man, an artist, collector of experience, the skeptic angling his head, his thoughts tilting toward what I cannot know, the marshaller of knowledge, knuckling down a stack of books, even the dissector, his scalpel in hand like a pen poised above me, aimed straight for my heart. Thank you. When I decided that I wanted to try to figure out something about these ideas about difference, inherent difference across time and space, I, of course, went first to the Enlightenment because my father is also someone I've had conversations with about Enlightenment philosophers for many years with, and so it was strange for me to go back and to realize that it was Kant who first codified a lot of the ideas about racial difference that have stayed with us in many ways today, not to mention, of course, Jefferson's ideas about difference. But I also thought I could go back farther than that, and I was sitting in my office one day and picked off of my shelf a book called The Panorama of the Renaissance, and there I saw for the first time an image of the miracle of the black leg. Now, the miracle of the black leg is the myth of the miraculous transplant performed by the patron saints of medicine, the brothers Cosmas and Damien, involving a black donor and a white recipient. The myth occurs in narratives, Greek narratives, for example, dating back to about the 12th century, and in pictorial representations dating to the mid-14th century, and appearing in several countries, including France, Spain, Belgium, Germany, Italy, Austria, Switzerland, and Portugal. One of the things that's interesting about these is that in the various panels of the representation of the myth, you see the doctors, for example, before they become saints, with a little hacksaw. They've just dug up a body and they're hacking the leg off. You also see later on when it becomes a living donor. Miracle of the black leg. Always the dark body hewn asunder. Always one man is healed, his sick limb replaced, placed in the other man's grave, the white leg buried beside the corpse or attached as if it were always there. If not for the dark appendage, you might miss the story beneath this story. What remains each time the myth changes? How, in one version, the doctors harvest the leg from a man 4 days dead in his tomb at the church of a martyr. Or, in another, desecrate a body fresh in the graveyard at St. Peter in chains. There was buried just today an Ethiopian. Even now, it stays with us. When we mean to uncover the truth, we dig, say, unearth. Emblematic in paint, a signifier of the body's lacuna, the black leg is at once a grafted narrative, a redacted line of text, and in this scene, a dark stocking pulled above the knee. Here, the patient is sleeping, his head at rest in his hand. Beatific, he looks as if he'll wake from a dream. On the floor beside the bed, a dead Moor, hands crossed at the groin, the swapped limb white and rotting, fused in place. And in the corner, a question, poised as if to speak the syntax of sloughing, a snake's curved form. It emerges from the mouth of a boy like a tongue, slippery and rooted in the body as knowledge. For centuries, this is how the myth repeats. The miracle, in words or wood or paint, is a record of thought. See how the story changes. In one painting, the Ethiop is merely a body, featureless in a coffin, so black he has no face. In another, the patient at the top of the frame seems to writhe in pain, the black leg grafted to his thigh. Below him, a mirror of suffering, the blackamoor, his body a fragment, arched across the doctor's lap as if dying from his wound. If not imminence, the soul's bright anchor, blood passed from one to the other, what knowledge haunts each body, what history, what phantom ache? One man always low in a grave or on the ground, the other up high, closer to heaven. One man always diseased, the other a body in service, plundered. Both men are alive in Violdo's carving. In twinned relief, they hold the same posture, the same pained face, each man reaching to touch his left leg. The black man on the floor holds his stump. Above him, the doctor restrains the patient's arm as if to prevent him touching the dark amendment of flesh. How not to see it? The men bound one to the other, symbiotic, one man rendered expendable, the other worthy of this sacrifice. In version after version, even when the Ethiopian isn't there, the leg is a stand-in. A black modifier against the white body, a piece cut off, as in the origin of the word comma, caesura in a story that's still being written. So it was perhaps Thomas Jefferson who, in his notes on the state of Virginia, first called for a kind of comparative anatomy, the idea that scientists should cut open the Negro in order to determine the site or the essence of his racial difference and her racial inferiority. Some doctors did this actually in the 19th century. This is Dr. Samuel Adolphus Cartwright on Dissecting the White Negro, 1851. To strip from the flesh the specious skin, to weigh in the brain pan seeds of white pepper, to find in the body its own diminishment, blood deep and definite, to measure the heft of lack, to make of the work of faith the work of science, evidence the word of God, Canaan be the servant of servants, thus to know truth of this derelict corpus, a dark compendium, this atavistic assemblage, flatter feet, bowed legs, a shorter neck, so deep the tincture. See it? We still know white from not. Thank you. Menopreita is just a term that means dark hand, used to suggest those with black blood who've been touched by the dark hand. Menopreita. The green drapery is like a sheet of water behind us, a cascade in the backdrop of the photograph, a rushing current that would scatter us, carry us each away. This is 1969, and I am 3. Still light enough to be nearly the color of my father. His armchair is a throne, and I am leaning into him, propped against his knees, his hand draped across my shoulder. On the chair's arm, my mother looms above me, perched at the edge as though she would fall off. The camera records her single gesture. Perhaps to still me, she presses my arm with a forefinger, makes visible a hypothesis of blood, its empire of words, the imprint on my body of her lovely, dark hand. This is after a photograph from the series The Americans by Robert Frank. Help, 1968. When I see Frank's photograph of a white infant in the dark arms of a woman who must be the maid, I think of my mother and the year we spent alone, my father at sea. The woman stands in profile, back against a wall, holding her charge. Their faces side by side, the look on the child's face strangely prescient, a tiny furrow in the space between her brows. Neither of them looks toward the camera, nor do they look at each other. That year, when my mother took me for walks, she was mistaken again and again for my maid. Years later, she told me she'd say I was her daughter, and each time strangers would stare in disbelief, then empty the change from their pockets. Now I think of the betrayals of flesh, how she must have tried to make of her face an inscrutable mask and hold it there as they made their small offerings, pressing coins into my hands. How, like the woman in the photograph, she must have seemed, carrying me each day, white in her arms, as if she were a prop, a black backdrop, the dark foil in this American story. Thank you. And this is another Costa painting poem. And the epigraph is from Albino and Spaniard, A Return Backwards is Born. And it's anonymous, circa 1785 to 1790. In the taxonomy of the Castas, Albina or Albino was someone with black blood. Torna atrás. The unknown artist has rendered the father a painter, and so we see him at his work, painting a portrait of his wife, their dark child watching nearby, a servant grinding colors in the corner. The woman poses just beyond his canvas and cannot see her likeness, her less-than-mirror image coming to life beneath his hand. He has rendered her homely. So unlike the woman we see in this scene, dressed in late-century fashion, a chicador, mark of beauty in the shape of a crescent moon affixed to her temple. If I say his painting is unfinished, that he is yet to make her beautiful, to match the elegant sweep of her hair, the graceful tilt of her head, has yet to adorn her dress with lace and trim, it is only one way to see it. You might see instead that the artist, perhaps to show his own skill, has made the father a dilettante, incapable of capturing his wife's beauty, or that he cannot see it, his mind's eye reducing her to what he's made as if to reveal the illusion imminent in her flesh. If you consider the centuries' mythology of the body, that a dark spot marked the genitals of anyone with African blood, you might see how the black moon on her white face recalls it, the Rosita she passes to her child, marking him torna atras. If I tell you such terms were born in the Enlightenment's hallowed rooms, that the wages of empire is myopia, you might see the father's vision as desire embodied in paint. This rendering of his wife, born of need to see himself as architect of truth, benevolent patriarch, father of uplift, ordering his domain. And you might see why, to understand my father, I look again and again at this painting, how it is that a man could love and so diminish what he loves. One of the things that I knew that I had to do in order to finish this book was to take my father to Monticello. And that's because about 25 years ago, my father took me to Monticello for the first time. And of course, you know, most of my life has been in debate with my father about Thomas Jefferson and how to think about whether or not he was the father of Sally Hemings' children. And so I knew that in order to finish this, I had to take him there. And a lot of things have changed at Monticello since we first went there 25 years ago. And one of those things is, of course, it is now the official position of the Jefferson Foundation that Jefferson fathered at least two of Sally Hemings' children. The docent will mention this upon entering the house at the beginning. Enlightenment. In the portrait of Jefferson that hangs at Monticello, he is rendered two-toned, his forehead white with illumination, a lit bulb, the rest of his face in shadow, darkened as if the artist meant to contrast his bright knowledge, its dark subtext. By 1805, when Jefferson sat for the portrait, he was already linked to an affair with his slave. Against a backdrop blue and ethereal, a wash of paint that seems to hold him in relief, Jefferson gazes out across the centuries, his lips fixed as if he's just uttered some final word. The first time I saw the painting, I listened as my father explained the contradictions, how Jefferson hated slavery, though out of necessity, my father said, had to own slaves. That his moral philosophy meant he could not have fathered those children, would have been impossible, my father said. For years, we debated the distance between word and deed. I'd follow my father from book to book, gathering citations, listen as he named, like a field guide to Virginia, each flower and tree and bird, as if to prove a man's pursuit of knowledge is greater than his shortcomings, the limits of his vision. I did not know then the subtext of our story, that my father could imagine Jefferson's words made flesh in my flesh, the improvement of the blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with the whites, or that my father could believe he'd made me better. When I think of this now, I see how the past holds us captive, its beautiful ruin etched on the mind's eye. My young father, a rough outline of the old man he's become, needing to show me the better measure of his heart, an equation writ large at Monticello. That was years ago. Now we take in how much has changed. Talk of Sally Hemings, someone asking, how white was she? Parsing the fractions as if to name what made her worthy of Jefferson's attentions. A near-white quadroon mistress, not a plain black slave. Imagine stepping back into the past, our guide tells us then. And I can't resist whispering to my father, this is where we split up. I'll head around to the back. When he laughs, I know he's grateful I've made a joke of it, this history that links us, white father, black daughter, even as it renders us other to each other. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to finish up with two poems now. Rotation. Like the moon that night, my father, a distant body, white and luminous. How small I was back then, looking up as if from dark earth. Distant, his body white and luminous, my father stood in the doorway. Looking up as if from dark earth, I saw him outlined in a scrim of light. My father stood in the doorway as if to watch over me as I dreamed. When I saw him outlined a scrim of light, he was already waning, turning to go. Once he watched over me as I dreamed. How small I was. Back then, he was already turning to go, waning like the moon that night, my father. My apologies to all the librarians in the room for this. You'll hear why, but at least some people do this in pencil. Illumination. Always there is something more to know. What lingers at the edge of thought awaiting illumination, as in this second-hand book, full of annotations, daring the margins in pencil, a light stroke as if the writer of these small replies meant not to leave them forever, meant to erase evidence of this private interaction. Here, a passage underlined. There, a single star on the page, as in a night sky, cloud-swept and hazy, where only the brightest appears, a tiny spark. I follow its coded message, try to read in it the direction of the solitary mind that thought to pencil in a jagged arrow. It is a bolt of lightning. Where it strikes, I read the line over and over, as if I might discern the little fire set, the flames of an idea licking the page, how knowledge burns. Beyond the exclamation point, its thin agreement, angle of surprise, there are questions, the word why. So much is left untold. Between the printed words and the self-conscious scrawl, between what is said and not, white space framing the story, the way the past, unwritten, eludes us. So much is implication, the afterimage of measured syntax, always there, ghosting the margins that words, their black-lined authority, do not cross. Even as they rise up to meet us, the white page hovers beneath, silent, incendiary, waiting. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha, for a terrific reading. I had the pleasure of hearing Natasha read her opening reading as the 19th Poet Laureate Consultant of Poetry at the Library of Congress just a few months ago, and this one was at least its equal. let's begin by talking about libraries. We are in the beautiful L.A. Central Library, mm-hmm. And their importance to you, and I know you've talked a little bit about your work at the Library of Congress to research the central poem in Native garb, but maybe you can talk even more generally about what libraries meant to you growing up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to John a little bit about this before the reading tonight during the reception, because at the very end of my nonfiction book, Beyond Katrina, there's a moment in which some people drive up and they're looking for the public library. And the public library in my hometown of Gulfport, Mississippi, is a place that I spent many hours as a child and also as an adult. There was even a little bit of research for Native Guard that took place in that library. And so there's a moment when I make a gesture to point to where it is before I remember that Hurricane Katrina had destroyed it. And as of now, the main branch of that public library is not being rebuilt. And so I was about to direct them to something of the past that no longer exists. And so for me, part of it is about, you know, what we've lost in that library, but how much libraries are part of our own experience growing up. And so for me, to have lost that library is to lose part of me, is to lose part of that childhood, part of that place that made me feel safe, that made me feel like I was in a haven for knowledge and ideas. And I think in many ways, leading me on a path of becoming a writer who deals with research and all the kinds of things that were available to me in that library. And of course, you mentioned the Library of Congress. I spent a wonderful summer working in both the Madison and the Jefferson buildings, doing research in the mornings and then taking what I had gathered there in my notes to go back over to the reading room in the Jefferson building and working on the poems and looking up and seeing all the words that go around the reading room, you know, poetry and history and all those things, and feeling like, yes, this is a place where poems should be made, in the seat of what seems like where knowledge lives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've known Natasha a long time, and I also know her husband, Brett, who is a historian at Emory University, where Natasha teaches. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what it's meant to have a life with him as a historian, how you and he have influenced each other's work. Natasha's also talked about wanting to be a historian poet in the mold of Robert Penn Warren, who was our very first poet laureate consultant in poetry back in the mid-'80s, so.
Well, I feel very lucky to have a historian living right inside the house. I don't have to seek them out. And, you know, our interests sort of dovetail nicely. I mean, he's a 20th century civil rights historian. And in many ways, my first book, Domestic Work, deals with a lot of those issues, poems that have a lot to do with the Jim Crow South, you know, moving from that period through the civil rights movement and beyond. But what's great about him is getting a sense of, since I'm not trained as a historian, I'm, you know, sort of floundering in some ways in terms of historiography, how to do the methodology of historical research. So it's great to be able to go to him and say, this is what I'm interested in, and for him to have a whole list of, if not books that I might look at first. Like a librarian, he can suggest search engines and, you know, Project Muse and all those different things that I figured out how to begin the research.
Yeah.
But he also, we read each other's work. He's not someone who considers himself in any way knowledgeable about poetry, but he's been to enough readings with me and he's read enough of my work to know what it is that I'm trying to do as a poet. So he's very attuned to the image in poetry. Mm-hmm. And when I show him drafts of my poems, if he says, oh, yes, I can see that, then I know I'm on the right track. But if he can't see it, then I know that I have not embodied, you know, the abstractions in some image that could connect to the kinds of readers, you know, across types of readers who might be able to engage with the poems.
Yeah. Well, speaking of seeing, so many of your poems this evening practice the art of ekphrasis, especially in engaging sort of historic moments. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk about how you begin that process, how that process of looking at a piece of art and reading into it, responding to it, contending with it, you know, reimagining it works for you.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that Mark Doty has written about this really beautifully in an essay called A Display of Mackerel. Well, it's about a poem called A Display of Mackerel, I should say. But what he talks about is exactly how it works for me, that I get struck by a particular image, just as he was struck by that display of mackerel, and begin only in description. I want to begin by trying to describe the image in such a way that it can stand it right there in front of the reader, is that the reader is there to look at the painting as well. And then I allow myself to make a few comparisons, a few figurative leaps, I think always lead to a kind of insight. I begin to see how I feel about what I'm looking at when I make the figurative comparisons that I hadn't expected to see that I would make.
I'm really drawn to doing that with photographs as well.
But recently, that's so strange to me. It's freaking me out to hear myself come in and out.
Go get it.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, but no, I think it's actually going off sometimes, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys see it. It's weird. It's not just me. All right. Okay.
We have that other kind of mic.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Well, I probably said enough.
Hardly. Please.
No, let's go on.
No, I'm slightly befuddled myself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. One of the things, you began the reading by talking about the relationship between public discourse and private conversation. And I wonder if you can talk about how readers of yours, or how the ideal reader can hear a reading like tonight, especially when you consider the poems you began with, mm-hmm. Elegy and Taxonomy, and sort of best understand the balance you're achieving between both of those in your work.
Well, you know, let me start by saying I mentioned in my introduction that I see Thrall as a very private, intimate conversation with my father taking place in a very public forum. I mean, this is a book not for my father, but the dedication actually reads to my father. And in deciding to do that, one of the things that I realized was important, and this may be something larger about poetry and not just about my relationship with my father, but that I needed to speak to my father in the only language that he would really listen to, and that's the language of poetry. And I think that that's a personal thing with my father because he's also a poet, but I also think it's what poetry does. It's a different kind of language that we listen to differently and we hear differently. And so that's one of the reasons that writing about history through poetry affects a different kind of understanding of the past than we might get reading wonderful historical monographs. I read many of them. But there's not just what happened, but also the possible worlds of what might have happened. And the lens of the poet and the poet's particular experience and the voice coming through to make sense of the past. For me, that is always about the intersection of public and personal history. Like most people, I'm deeply interested in my own experience, my own place in the world, and yet I can't imagine investigating that without investigating the larger web of history of which we are all part. And so in Thrall, what I try to do that's a little bit different in terms of the structure of the book that came before it, for example, is to not have discrete sections that deal with personal history and then public history, but to actually try to weave poems back and forth that look at, you know, this
private history and the public history, and also to have some poems that enact something private and public at once, like the poem Enlightenment about our visit to Monticello. Right. I mean, there we are in the sight of public history, but there's a very private and intimate thing going on within that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has to contend with both.
It has to contend with that larger history that we are products of, enthralled to.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more too about persona poems. You didn't focus on them so much this evening, but so many of the poems in your books, or poems throughout the books, your four books of poems, engage with and speak through the voices of others. And I wonder just what they offer you, how they relate, you think, to the poems of yours that speak in the eye of Natasha, Natasha Trethewey, or a Natasha.
Well, you know, it's a good question to follow your previous question, because it helps me to see in some ways that it really is, again, about history, and it's about linking the personal and the public. You know, putting on the mask of that allows one to write a persona also allows the poet to dig even deeper into the self, because the mask permits that. So I find that those persona poems, even if they're about, you know, characters a century or more removed from me, are some of the most personal poems I've written. And yet, what they allow me to do is to place the sort of the interior landscape of my own psyche within the body of a character living in a different time, living with a different history. So it gives me access to situations, language, even ideas that wouldn't necessarily be part of my own, you know, particular moment. I like that I get to inhabit another time and space in order to make sense of what is deeply personal for me. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, I wonder, do you have any questions? We'd love to hear from you. Someone right down here.
As you write, is there an intended audience in your mind or heart? Who do you write for?
Oh, I think everyone. You know, I began thinking about this with my very first book, and one of the things that was important to me about that book, because my grandmother was actually a subject of many of the poems in Domestic Work, I wanted to write those poems such that my grandmother and, you know, the other 80-some-year-old ladies in her church could read those poems and see very clearly and know exactly what I was talking about. But I also wanted, you know, people who are poetry lovers to also find something in those poems, people who are critics of poetry to also, if they read deeply enough, to see what else is going on. You know, I imagine an audience, you know, like Chaucer's, you know, ordinary people, but, you know, those of us now who are reading back across the centuries to see what else is going on.
I imagine there was a lot of catharsis involved in the writing of these poems. I was wondering, however, given the nature of the project, it seems as though the kind of cathartic experiences that you may have had would be ongoing. And consequently, if I'm right about that, I wondered how you felt, or if you had some kind of an epiphany, or what the experience was like when you were assured that this was enough for this particular collection that you've entitled Thrall. Did something experientially make you sense that it was time to close it off?
Well, you know, it was, for me, so far the most difficult book I've had to write, and I think it is because I had to recognize some difficult things about my father and my relationship to my father, which, of course, turns the lens and makes it even larger, and I begin to see those same things manifest in our interactions with each other out in the world. I mean, to look at deeply ingrained and inherent notions of white supremacy that still exist, and to find them so deeply ingrained in my own beloved father, such that I have to make an assertion about, you know, whether or not my father felt that, you know, his injection of white blood made me a better person than I would have been otherwise. That's a hard thing to imagine, you know, that your father thinks about you. Just as for many women, it's, you know, hard to also realize that your father thinks, you know, you have less capacity because of your gender. These are tough things to realize that the people who love us think. It's hard enough to know that, you know, the cops or other people out in society are making these decisions about us. But when it's your own father, I mean, that's a tough thing. So, you know, that was hard to reckon with. And yet, it doesn't change that I love my father, that he loves me. I mean, that part still remains and is what is most illuminating about our experiences as human beings, that our relationships are always complex and complicated like that. That's an ongoing process. As I mentioned about getting to the end, even the end of the poem, Enlightenment, suggests something about my realization that otherness goes both ways, too, that my father becomes other to me as well. Now, the power is a little different, but otherness nonetheless. That seemed like a place to stop, at least for now.
Hi, thank you for beautiful work. I teach at a college, our mascot is the poet, and our slogan is Fear the Poet.
Oh, yes, I have that
world?
T-shirt.
Yes,
really?
from your husband, yes. I wanted to ask about the work of the Poet Laureate, since it's a lot of work to put those words together, and I want to ask where you write, how many hours a day, what is the work day of the Poet Laureate?
Well, I'm moving to Washington in January, and so I'll be in the office, and what I'm hoping, they've set up a lovely space for me, a desk that that I think I'll be able to get work done. I'm looking forward to getting over there in the morning and spending time in the collections and in the reading room and in that office. I'd also like, while I'm there, to be able to hold some occasional office hours where people get to come visit the Poetry Center, talk about poetry, give me ideas, ask questions. I imagine that will be a harder balancing act to do, to find time, you know, to write, but also to be a public figure for poetry and to act as an advocate in that way. I don't know yet how it's going to go, but Rob will be there. I think they'll let me close my door when I need to.
Indeed.
But I think it'll be open a good part of the time as well.
I hope this doesn't sound too presumptuous, but why do you stay in Mississippi, and how does that influence your poetry?
Well, you know, I'm also the first poet laureate of the state of Mississippi who does not exactly live in Mississippi. I live in Atlanta. It's still the South, but it's the New South, capital of the New South. But Mississippi made me. You know, geography is fate. And so having come from that place has everything to do with my concerns and obsessions as a poet. And I often go back there because I need to inhabit the physical space in order to connect that to the landscape of the psyche. So I travel back there frequently, but I don't live there. My brother still lives there. That's all. That's all that's left.
Hi, Natasha. And
hey,
and welcome.
Lynn.
I was thinking what a marvelous synchronicity it is that you're the Poet Laureate at the commencement of the second term of President Obama. Mm. And wondering if you have had or will have an opportunity to meet with him and talk about literature. I know he's a poetry supporter. And just wonder if you've had that chance or you've thought about it and what may come of that.
Well, I guess he's going to be really busy. you know, I would love to say, Mr. President, please make some time for poetry. Maybe he will hear something about this conversation that we're having today, and I'll get to talk to him about it. I don't know that there's a chance, but if there's room in his schedule, I'd love to be able to talk to him about what we all can do for American poetry and getting poetry to a wider audience.
Many of your the endings of your poems seemed remarkable to me, and I was wondering what you see the job of the ending to be, and what you try to have it accomplish, and when you know you've had it, what the test is, or what your philosophy is about it.
Yeah, I'm really interested in endings, and when I was a younger poet. And I think in some ways this still happens to me, but I have to resist it in some ways. Endings would come before anything else. And what's dangerous to me about that is that the poem could end up with me writing it toward that ending, and it would become a means to that end rather than an end in itself. And so to try to, I had to find ways to circumvent that impulse that I have, where I already see, you know, where an ending's going. And so, you know, early on, too, as a younger poet, I felt like my endings seemed to tie or wrap up way too much. And so the first thing I started teaching myself to do was to get rid of whatever ending I had. If there was a last line, I would just strike through it and end with the one that came before it, which taught me something about openness rather than closing. You know, I wanted an ending always to open and be larger than what the poem has already done, than be something that closes and just puts the final nail in the coffin of what the poem has done.
Two more questions, okay.
Hi, Natasha. Thank you for the beautiful reading. My question is, at the beginning you said you look at the Mexican history in regards to how the Spaniards came about, and that is still going on with the indigenous history. Mm-hmm. What brought you to go into that part of history?
It was seeing those paintings, and I didn't know about the Costa paintings until, I guess, about 2005, and I met a scholar, a woman who was doing research on privacy in the age of Shakespeare, and she had been to a museum in England, Braemore House, that had a series of the Costa paintings by Juan Rodriguez Suarez, and she saw them, and we were just having a conversation, and this is sort of serendipity. It happens all the time, which is why I love being in conversation with people who know a lot of stuff. And who know different stuff than I do. She just said to me one day, I think you'd be really interested in these paintings. And so the first one I saw was the one that's the cover of this book. And, you know, there I was looking at an image of my own family, and I had to see more of them. And so I started looking at more of the paintings, reading a lot of histories that have been written about the role of those paintings in colonial Mexico. And I was just taken with it. And, you know, coming from the region of the United States that I'm from, an hour outside of New Orleans is a place full of those kinds of taxonomies as well. So I had grown up with knowing the different terms for the various blood mixtures. And to see that this was taking place, you know, across time and space in many other places just allowed a way for me to try to investigate things that I've, you know, been obsessed with in terms of trying to make sense of who I am in the world.
What inspires you to write each poem?
In 20 words or less.
I was going to say, well, okay, let me start with the first one. You know, because of course it's you know, it's always different. But beneath it all, even when I don't know it, I can see across all of my books the things that I'm concerned with. I am concerned with the intersections of personal and public history. I'm concerned with cultural memory and historical erasure, our amnesia as a people, the kinds of things that we try to remember by erecting monuments, and all the things that we try to erase and forget, both on a personal level and on a national level. I think that's always behind whatever it is I write, even if I don't know it until I start describing what I'm looking at.
Well, that's an amazing place to end this event. Thanks so much to our poet laureate.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.